Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the second edition of The Political Football, a special podcast series from These Football Times. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, in so many places around the world, though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioned devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations, or indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence, or increase their power by using football as a political tool. This series looks at a few examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces. It also questions whether at times football has kicked back against such forces and provided a means to counter them. This is The Political Football, and today we'll be looking at Chile and Argentina. I'm Gary Thacker, and I'm delighted to be co-hosting this series with my good friend Stu Horsfield. How are you doing, Stu?
Yeah, good, thanks, Gary. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, mate. Looking forward to tonight's episode. I think it's going to be absolute banging.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, I think the subject matter, the geographical location, the guest that we've got on tonight, I think all of it is going to add up to a really, really good discussion.
Okay, so who's our guest tonight then, Stu?
So, tonight our guest is Mr. Dan Williamson. Dan actually undertook a course on Latin American studies at the University of Liverpool with a dissertation that was actually focused on Las Malvinas in the Argentine education system. Graduated in 2014 as a, in his words, a mature student, but actually spent a year living in Cordoba, Argentina during his studies. His knowledge and empathy for the region is therefore pretty well established. Dan's actually a senior writer and a very good senior writer for These Football Times. Passionate, massively knowledgeable advocate for South American football. He's written a number of outstanding articles for These Football Times, many of which obviously focus on his favourite subject, South America and its football, but he still doesn't neglect the other aspects of the game. It's also worth mentioning, actually, that Dan also runs the Open Veins of Football website, which is excellent. And with his expert help, we're going to be looking at the Southern Cone countries of Argentina and Chile and how the political football has manifested itself in the region.
How are you doing, Dan?
Hi, good, Gary. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. I think anyone who heard me on the World Cup podcast for 1978 knows I like to ramble on about this topic. So
I was on that one. It was excellent.
Yeah, it went on for a while, didn't it?
It was a good discussion, though.
It was really enjoyable.
It sounds like our sort of ideal guest, that does, Dan. Okay, to kick us off, Dan, do you want to give us a little outline of the political context of the political football in Argentina and Chile?
Yeah, so we'll pick up the story in the 1970s. We've got two neighbouring countries, the two southernmost countries in South America, which are separated by the Andes Mountains. Going back to the 1970s, across the continent, it was an era in which most of the countries, almost without exception, suffered from military dictatorships. So kind of like we're seeing now at the moment with Trump, Brexit, right-wing parties popping up in Germany and Italy. All almost seems to come as a wave, you know, whether it's left wing, right wing, we always see a wave of the same kind of politics, and it happened over there in the 70s and 80s. So both countries suffered under that military dictatorship, and the backdrop also, which is important to mention, is the Cold War as well between the US and the Soviet Union, between capitalism and communism. Latin America was a fertile battleground for this war. And the USA have often said that Latin America is their backyard. So they were seeking to eradicate communism, basically wherever it popped up, eradicate Soviet influence as well. And both Chile and Argentina were caught up in this war.
Okay, buddy. That's okay. That sets the scene nicely. So there are two countries involved, you mentioned here, Argentina and Chile. So Can you tell us about any similarities or differences between the two and how the political forces use football?
Yeah, sure. So I'll carry on just outlining a bit of the political context as well before we go into the football, just to sort of set the scene. Both countries, as I mentioned, both countries suffered under military dictatorships, and both suffered military coups. So, interestingly enough, Tuesday will be the 45th anniversary of Chile's coup. So the 11th of September, obviously, a date that's synonymous with the Twin Towers attack in New York. But for Chileans, it obviously holds a different memory as well. In 1973, they suffered a coup. The democratically elected president, Salvador Allende, was overthrown. He ended up shooting himself with a rifle that was allegedly a gift from Fidel Castro. So he was really aligning himself with the left, and obviously a lot of people didn't like that, should we say, if that's a simplistic way of putting it. But he was ousted, replaced by a military regime. The figurehead of that regime was a quite despicable chap called General Augusto Pinochet, a friend of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, which tells you all you need to know. And he ruled with an iron fist for more than 15 years. Over in Argentina, similar kind of thing. They had a coup in 1976. There was chaos, really, from probably about 1973, 1974, for a couple of year period. Juan Perón, his name is synonymous with Argentine politics. He came back in 1973 from exile, won the elections, but he died a year later. His wife was put in charge, but she had no place, really, being the president of the nation. And, you know, in the chaos that ensued, the military stepped in and, you know, believing that they were the only institution that could return order to the country. Both these countries were involved in something called Operation Condor that was adopted by not just those two governments. It was adopted by other governments in South America as well. These governments were seeking cooperation in the fight against communism. They shared info on dissidents. They transported people cross borders and basically handed over anyone that they thought was communist, basically. So if a communist popped up in Chile, they'd hand him over to Argentina and so on. All the funds were routed through the CIA, so it was something that went deep through US politics, and it's been attributed, 80,000 deaths have been attributed to this policy, and over 500,000 political prisoners as well. So it was quite a nasty operation, and obviously, like I said, the US were heavily involved behind the scenes. So that's the sort of political context in a bit more detail. And in terms of football, we've got the World Cup, which I think we can talk about in a bit more detail. And also over in Chile, there were issues with the national stadium being used as a concentration camp, which is, I think, a lot of it focuses around that. And also a match against the USSR. I think Stephen was mentioning it last week as well. A World Cup qualifier between Chile and the USSR, which is heavily involved in this story too.
Yeah. Okay, Matty. Stu.
Yeah. I knew this would be, you know, heavily politicised, obviously, as per the title of the series. But obviously, listening to you there, Dan, I mean, it's incredible the influence from essentially at the time were the two global superpowers in terms of Russia and the Soviet Union and America. Do you think, before we get onto the football, as a personal interest, do you think the American involvement has been fully divulged, or do you think there are almost other things that America could take responsibility for that maybe haven't come out yet or aren't in the public domain?
Absolutely, yeah. I think I don't know really how widely known it is, the US involvement in all of this, and in a lot of the, basically all across Latin America, in Central America, there have been quite a few scandals uncovered in Central America, in South America, all during this period. And I think a lot of it's only come out recently because of the, I'm not sure what the act is called, where information is basically kept behind for X amount of years. I think we have it over here, don't we, in the UK, where is it 30 years?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it has come out since that's been lifted as well. So, but yeah, I think everyday people probably don't really associate anything to do with this, with the US.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, certainly Operation Condor is certainly not something I was fully aware of, and certainly not to the extent, like you say, of the US involvement. In terms of, I'm sorry, I know we will get to the football, I promise, but I'm fascinated. In terms of, I suppose, the reward system that was in place then, the payoff for the South American countries and the American involvement, was it either financial or was it the support of military rule within that country, which was the trade-off in terms of helping, like you say, eradicate communism?
I think probably a bit of both, really, and a lot of it is just ideology as well. You've got a lot of people who just didn't like the idea of communists and left-wing influence, and these people, you know, if the US are coming in and offering their support like they did with this Operation Condor, then, you know, you're going to get people on the right-hand side that are trying to take advantage of that, really. So I think it was a mixture of financial just ideological support, really.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Gary, brilliant. Yeah, I'm good to go with the football now.
Let's get the ball out now. We've painted the backdrop, I mean, which is, as you say, Stu, it's fascinating, and it's difficult to understand the football element of it without knowing the environment in which the game's being played. So there's a couple of things I want to pick about. Let's start with Chile, Dan, and three sort of subjects that you sort of touched on there, and one more. Firstly, the Estadio Nacional, which I think is obviously you mentioned about the concentration camp, the football stadium, and the Ghost Match. And I'm not sure if you mentioned him, Carlos Caselli, is it?
Yeah, he's a really interesting character. I wrote about him for the site about a year ago, and you can kind of almost chart the whole history of this through his career, which is quite fascinating. So I can sort of whiz through a few of those bits, and then we can delve in a bit further detail.
But
it starts just to paint the picture. Carlos Caselli was he's got a bit of a weird, well, not a weird surname, sorry. It's not a Spanish surname. His dad was Hungarian, and he was a striker for Colo Colo, which is one of the biggest teams in Chile. He was part of the national team as well. So when the World Cup qualifiers came around for the West German World Cup in 1974, he was involved in the national team. So the first leg of that game actually came 15 days after the coup. It was a 0-0 draw in Moscow between Chile and the USSR, and played out in freezing conditions, but the Soviets' hospitality was legendary, should we say. They didn't really welcome the guests with open arms, obviously knowing that Chile were, for want of a better phrase, in bed with the Americans. They made it as difficult as possible. They detained them at the airport for hours, and it wasn't very comfortable. So came away with a 0-0 draw. And then the Ghost Match, as you mentioned, was due to take place, and at the Estadio Nacional, which is the national stadium, as the name suggests, in Chile's capital. Gorgeous stadium. It's got a lovely backdrop as well of the Andes, snow-capped mountains. It's quite a fascinating sight, really. But the problem was that the military regime had set up a concentration camp. So in the months that followed the coup, people were up to about 6,000 people were alleged to have been imprisoned there. They were sort of living out on the pitch and in the stands, and then they'd get taken into the bowels of the stadium for, you know, interrogation, torture. Music blared out of the speakers to drown out any cries and gunshots. It's quite a disgusting thought, really. So the Soviets got wind of this, and they complained to FIFA. FIFA came over and basically uncovered nothing. They said, oh, everything's fine, you know, life's back to normal, nothing to worry about. Soviet said, you know, absolutely not, we don't believe you, we don't agree with this. And to cut a long story short, they ended up pulling out of the game completely. Chile still had to take to the field anyway to you know, take out the formalities, and referee blew the whistle, kicked off, and they just sort of rolled the ball into the empty net, and they were awarded a 2-0 win. Quite a strange sort of thought, really. You can't imagine that happening nowadays, can you? Carlos Caselli, he represented the national team in the Ghost Match, and he his words exactly were that it was a worldwide embarrassment. So that's the Ghost Match. Do you want a bit more details on Caselli?
Yeah, please. Caselli sounds like a really interesting character.
Yeah, he a fascinating character. Like the people that we, you know, enjoy writing about, he's a really colourful character. He's not just a footballer. He likes to get involved in a bit of mischief and controversial character. He was one of the most high profile people that actually opposed Pinochet openly. A lot of famous Chileans were actually disappeared themselves as well. So there's singers, there's the poet Pablo Neruda. He passed away a few days after the coup, which is a bit of a coincidence, isn't it? But Caselli was really open in his opposition. He didn't hide it one bit. He first met Pinochet, or what I know to be his first meeting, was just before the Chile national team departed for the World Cup in West Germany. And this is something we see nowadays, isn't it, where political leaders will, you know, try and sort of glad hand national teams before they go away and for a bit of a photo opportunity. It's almost like they're trying to link themselves and trying to sort of attach themselves to the success, isn't it? So Pinochet was no different. He met the team before they left, and I've got a quote here from Caselli, which is quite interesting. It's worth reading out. It says, "When we were all standing there, the doors open and there comes a guy with a cape, dark glasses and a hat. A cold shiver went down my back from seeing this Hitler-like thing until five guys behind him. When he started coming closer, I put my hand behind me and I didn't give it him." So basically, he refused to shake his hand. So obviously, a guy like Pinochet is not going to forget this. Yeah. They bumped heads again in 1985, and Caselli at this point, he was wearing a red tie when they met. So red obviously being a colour that's synonymous with communism. Pinochet made a motion with his fingers as if he was going to cut the tie, and Caselli said, "You may do it, but my heart will forever remain red."
Because of his footballer, was that protecting him? Obviously, that took massive courage to stand up against a dictator like Pinochet. But did he have that? Was his fame as a footballer some kind of shield?
I guess it must have been. I mean, like I said, famous people, like really famous people, like Pablo Neruda, they seem to suffer a sort of quick end. And it's interesting that Caselli didn't fall under that. And it must be his fame as a footballer. He was a very famous, popular man at the time. And that just shows the importance of football, doesn't it? That singers and poets and other famous people suffer, but a footballer just deemed almost untouchable.
Yeah, I mean, before we move on to Argentina, let's do talk about Argentina with you. We'll just move on to that though. How was football affected during Pinochet's reign? Did he have any effect on the domestic game?
I'm going to be completely honest. I'm not sure about that. How it affected the domestic game. Yeah. One more thing though, I want to mention about Caselli. He wasn't affected, but I'll jump ahead a few years because it's interesting. It's interesting to just finish off talking about Caselli. There was a lot of public pressure from sort of businesses, international community about the regime coming towards the end of the 80s. So Pinochet actually called a referendum, and the referendum was to decide whether he would remain or whether the country would return to democratic elections. So he basically said, if I win, I get an unopposed 8-year term, and if I lose, then we go back to democratic elections. So the armed forces didn't think they'd lose whatsoever. And the campaign for the no campaign, which was like, no, you can't stay, they cleverly used TV as a medium. The army were really complacent in this referendum, but the no campaign were really, really fervent. And there was one broadcast, and an elderly lady was on the screen, and she was recounting her experiences under the regime, having been kidnapped, tortured.
Written the famous guy, and there must be tens of thousands of not famous people that that don't get mentioned at all.
I mean, there's obviously a couple of things from, you know, from what Stan said, certainly about Chile. I mean, one, you know, is obviously the outstanding bravery of Caselli. I mean, you talk about this Hitler-like dictator that Pinochet was, but I mean, for such blatant and obvious and public disregard for what was essentially, you know, an incredibly cruel man, you know, seems an incredibly brave thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. He was quite a fiery character, which often came out on the pitch as well. I think he was the first ever player, if you recall, he was in the 1974 World Cup, the first ever player to receive a physical red card at a World Cup. So yellow and red cards came out for 1970, but wasn't actually brandished. He picked up the first one. So it just sort of shows he's got a bit of a fiery character. But it was hugely, hugely brave of him to step up like that. And like we said before, it can only be football that really saved him. So he's a lucky guy, really.
It is, if you don't mind, Gary, just ask Dan one other question, because the ghost game, like you said, we talked about with Stephen, and you know, you mentioned the point, Dan, that FIFA sent, you know, dispatched, you know, a group to go and have a look at the stadium. It was an incredibly cursory sort of look around the stadium. You know, there's talk of prisoners in the changing rooms, in the very bowels of the stadium. And like you say, if you've seen the stadium goes incredibly deep, and a lot of them were locked away there. And you know, the FIFA delegates really were never shown it. And it was actually under Stanley Rouse's presidency, obviously, you know, the Englishman Stanley Rouse, who was president at the time, and he was happy with the report that came back, and you know, the game to go ahead. But we asked the question, you know, whether Russia were actually embarrassed by that 0-0 draw and used it as an opportunity to not go, or whether, you know, it was actually a matter of principle and Russia were never going to play that game as it stood. I mean, you know, what do you think? Do you think Russia took the easy way out, if you like, you know, the draw 0-0, which was seen as an embarrassment, or do you think it was, without doubt, a matter of principle as to what was happening in Chile at the time?
Yeah, interesting point, because FIFA at one point talked about moving the game to Spain as a sort of way to appease the Soviets, and, you know, neutral venue, and apparently they said no. So they were almost given a sort of olive branch, and they turned it down. But then on the other hand, I'm not sure which Olympics it was, but they pulled out of one of the Olympics. Was it Los Angeles 82?
Was.
And was that for the same reason? That was for the same reason of the, obviously it was in US. So, but they've got form really of pulling out on ideological grounds. So I think it's probably a mixture of both, really.
Yeah. Sorry, go on, Gary.
I say it'd be interesting to see what their situation was if they'd have won 4-0 in Moscow. Would that have changed their political approach? I mean, who knows? Who knows? And, you know. Go on.
I was just going to say, you know, 0-0 draw and then having to travel all the way to South America in those days would have been an arduous trip, as it was for the Chileans coming to Moscow. So perhaps they saw the writing on the wall. But I think as the Olympics shown, they have got a form of ideological stances. So I guess we'll never know about that one.
Yeah. Let's move on to Argentina, Dan. I mean, this is obviously a place where you spent your life living, which must have been, I mean, a way to get into a culture of a country. You couldn't possibly pick a better way than living there. So many similarities. I mean, there was dictatorship, as you said, in Argentina, every bit as brutal as the one in Chile. And there was also the concentration camp at the Estadio Monumental in Buenos Aires. And if you talk about the World Cup in 78 and a little bit perhaps about Menotti.
Yeah, so Menotti, sorry to keep plugging my own pieces, but I've actually got a piece coming in the next few days on the site about Menotti. He and his championship win with Huracan, who are a sort of small, not I wouldn't say small team, but they're not one of the big five teams. But he that where he rose to prominence was with Huracan in 1973. He played a absolutely stunning brand of football, And he was appointed as the national team manager on the back of his success with Huracán in 1974. So Argentina went to the World Cup in 74, had a disastrous time. They were trounced by the Netherlands 4-0 with Cruyff bagging a brace. And basically, they were the changes were wrong. Menotti comes in as the manager, so he's also always really been known for his left wing ideals. So he's a bit of a romantic, and he was the national team manager that the regime inherited when they took power in 1976. So there's obviously going to be clashes there, and you know, people have asked Menotti about this and how can you sort of match your ideals with managing Argentina during this time? And he sort of said, well, you know, I'm a coach. I want to win football matches. And it's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what you guys think about that, but what would you do? You know, you're obviously opposed to the politics, but you're still a sort of sportsman and you still want to win football matches, don't you?
Yeah. And I suppose you can sort of rationalise those sort of things in your mind, correctly or incorrectly, that, you know, you're not managing the team for the regime, you're managing the team for the country.
There are a couple of quotes that have been attributed to him as well, where he's sort of saying, you know, almost the brand of football that I play, that's almost like a protest in itself, you know, a bit of a subliminal silent protest to say, you know, look at this sort of free-flowing beauty that's completely at odds with the rigid sort of ideals of the military regime, really, you know, a bit of a, it's almost like a left-wing style of football, if you like.
The number 11, number 7, then, Dan.
Say again, sorry?
He plays with the number 11, not the number 7, he plays on the left wing.
Yes.
Sorry, Stu.
Yeah, can I just ask a question, Dan? I mean, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but obviously, you know, you talk about Menotti and the difficult sort of position that he was in, and he was, you know, the dictatorship actually inherited Menotti. Do you think there was ever a danger of, how can I put it, Menotti being relieved of duties, or was the football, like we've talked about, was it just too powerful? Was the Argentine national team too powerful, or the position of national team coach too powerful, even for the dictatorship to do anything about? Was he ever in danger of being removed? I suppose you could argue for his political ideology.
No, I think it was sort of thought that there was too little time, really. So he was kind of left in place. There was also other things they couldn't change either. The logo was it was based on Perón's open hand gesture. So it was, if you can recall, it was two hands with a ball floating in between. Basically, it was too well known at the time to get rid of it and start from scratch, really. So it's quite funny that they had to suffer with his logo all the way through the World Cup. Going back to what Gary mentioned before, yes, the concentration camp, it was actually the naval school. It was about two blocks away from the stadium where the World Cup final would be held. So similar to when we talked about the Estadio Nacional, you had more than 5,000 people killed there. This was the bloodiest concentration camp that the regime had. They had more than 300 across the country. And, you know, it's been said that the prisoners could actually hear the roars of the crowd, which is quite a cruel thought, really. As the games were going on and goals were going in, they could hear the roars of the crowd. And there's also rumours that people in the stadium could hear the gunshots as well. So it gives you an idea of how close it was.
Obviously, it's horrific. It's a horrific thing to think about. But do you think that was intentional?
In what way?
Well, if you're trying to subvert the public and you have this concentration camp so close, and you say that the crowd could hear the gunshots, I mean, it's propaganda of the highest order, isn't it? In terms of sort of almost controlling the public, it's implied what's happening, but it's never overtly publicised, if that makes sense. But it's a way of showing control. I was just wondering whether you thought that was maybe, you know, done, or you talk about it being the bloodiest concentration camp. Was there a reason behind that?
You know, that's a really good angle, Stu, and I've actually never thought about that myself. So you've opened up my eyes to something quite interesting.
Dan, trust me, all this comes from you. Honestly, I'm just sat here listening, absorbed, just with a million things going through my head.
No, I think you're right that if it was, it was probably perhaps more subliminal than anything. There was still a lot of people that didn't really know what was going on at this stage. So I don't think it was anything overt. A lot of people weren't aware of what was going on. There's quite a few players have since said, you know, we didn't know what was happening. If you think about it, this is an era before social media. News wasn't shared so freely as it would be now, you know.
Yeah.
Now if there's an earthquake somewhere, we know about it in 30 seconds. But some of the players have come out and said, you know what, we genuinely didn't know all of what was happening, you know, the full extent of what was happening. So I would probably say that it was more subliminal than anything. But yeah, like you say, what a way to sort of scare people if people are thinking that there's something so close to where the World Cup final is happening.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier about Operation Condor, Dan, and there was a famous, or almost infamous game in the 1978 World Cup between Argentina and Peru, where Argentina, I think, needed to win by 3 or 4 goals, and they actually won by 6, and there was talk that the Peruvian president had basically instructed his team to lose and allow Argentina to qualify because there was an agreement that some Peruvian guys taking refuge in Argentina would be handed over. Now, I guess these things sort of become almost apocryphal anyway, but that sort of thing, I suppose you can almost see it happening, can't you?
Absolutely, yeah. It's that game is, I think, will be forever in folklore. Like you mentioned, that there's talk of handing over prisoners, which was one of the key tenets of Operation Condor, you know, cooperation with regards to dissidents in each other's countries. There's talk about debts being free, you know, cleared, a grain shipment to Peru from Argentina. But I think it's interesting because you've got the Peru team. It was 4-0 that Argentina needed to win, or by 4 goals. And
right.
Peru had only conceded 4 goals in the whole tournament, so it was a tall ask. Argentina went and won 6-0. And it's quite interesting because Jonathan Wilson, in his book, he almost seems to not rule out any underhand doings, but he seems to think that Argentina just basically overwhelmed them, and you know, when it got towards the end of the game, the Peruvians just collapsed, really. That not that anything was untoward, but just that it was purely a footballing you know, it wasn't anything political, really. You've got, you know, Peru hit the post a couple of times, so it wasn't like they weren't trying. Peru had an Argentine-born goalkeeper in net, which added you know, fuel to the flames, but he made some good saves as well. So he just attributes it to, you know, the Peruvians just not really fancying it when the going got tough.
Yeah, I suspect he's probably the minority.
Yeah, it's one of those, you just never know the exact... I mean, people have come out on both sides, you know, some of the Peruvians have come out and said, you know, this definitely happened, you know, but then other people have refuted their accounts. So I think it's just one of those that will just go down in history as one of those great conspiracy theories.
I mean, it's funny, isn't it, because you've got to look at FIFA again, haven't you, there, where you have this situation with a team going into a final game knowing the result. I mean, now it doesn't happen because both group games are played at the same time, but the fact that I suppose FIFA could allow a situation whereby the host nation would know exactly what result they needed to progress to the next round, it left itself open, didn't it, to implications of bribery.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It stinks, really, doesn't it? That, I think the frustrating thing is that there's never really been a definitive answer. And Peru were a cracking side in the 70s as well, weren't they? So it was to go and beat them 6-0. It does raise a few eyebrows.
Yeah, was there? We mentioned Carlos Caselli in relation to Chile. Was there any parallels in Argentina with the players there that stood up to the regime?
There were quite a few players that have come out since. They basically, like I said before, a lot of people said they just didn't know. You know, they just didn't know the full extent of what was happening. So, but a lot of players have come out since, and they've said, you know, had we known what was going on, we wouldn't have taken part. Ricky Vischer, who played for Spurs with Ozzy Ardiles, he came out and said, you know, you know, if I knew Leopoldo Luque as well, who was a key part of that team, he said, you know, with what I know now, I can't say I'm proud of my victory. And I think there was another player I mentioned him briefly in my Menotti piece that's coming up, Karis Korsa. He basically refused to play for the national team during this period, even though Menotti was his, you know, they were sort of tied from the Huracan days. But Menotti said to him, look, you know, you can be a key player for this national team going into this home World Cup. And he just said, you know, no, I don't want to play for the national team while the regime are in charge. So you've got a few players there that did sort of say, you know, I'm not interested in playing. I don't think there's anyone that I'm aware of that was as open as Cazelli and as brazen as Cazelli. One thing I forgot to mention, though, before when we're talking about Cazelli is he actually left Chile to play in Spain for 5 years during the early years, which is possibly another aspect of what saved him. Sure. He was able to do that because of his profile, but obviously not everyone else gets that same luxury. And in Argentina, I think apart from Mario Kempes, everyone played domestically. So you've not got that ability to go abroad and maybe to read about what's going on in foreign newspapers. Everything you're getting is being spoon-fed to you from you know, state-controlled media.
It's interesting that you mentioned about Ricky Villa and a couple of Luque and others that said, if they'd have known, I wouldn't have played. And you want to believe that they're being sincere, but it's also, you know, there's a nagging doubt that's saying, well, that's easy to say that afterwards. And so I forgot the guy's name you mentioned who said he wouldn't play. You know, if someone knows, if one guy knows what's going on, it's not that difficult to assume it's, I won't say common knowledge, but there must at least have been suspicions about what's going on there. If you live in a military dictatorship, you know that you live in a military dictatorship.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a bit of that. I think people would have been aware that something wasn't right, you know, that they were living in a military dictatorship and things were happening, but it wasn't like everybody knew the extent of what was happening. So that, I think that's the key thing, really, that people didn't know exactly the full extent of the horrors. They knew something wasn't right, but not everything. So it's kind of like a bit of a grey area, if you like.
Sure.
And I agree, though, what you say about it is quite easy to come out and say after the fact, oh, you know, I wouldn't have done this. But how do you know? And like I said before about Menotti, when he said, you know, I'm a professional, I want to win football matches. You know, what do you expect me to do? Do you expect me to lose, kind of thing? It's that sort of dilemma, isn't it, between the sporting side of it and the political side, and what do you do? And I think it's hard for us to sit here 30, 40 years later and say, you know, we would have done this or we wouldn't have done that.
Of course, I guess it's, you know, if you're, you know, Luque, for example, and you said, I'm not going to play, would it have brought the military regime down? Of course it wouldn't. Would it have made any difference in the end? Of course it wouldn't. So
no.
There's that logic to it as well, that, you know, there's no point in fighting a battle that's not going to, you're not going to make any difference to. If you can bring joy to some oppressed people, then that's probably the best thing to do anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And this, you know, the fact that everyone didn't know the full extent, 4 years later was the 1982 World Cup. The players said they didn't know what was going on in the Falklands Malvinas War until they arrived in Spain. So, you know, that's another 4 years in the future. You know, 4 years more of advancements, maybe with technology, but they still didn't know really what was going on. You know, they were still kind of in the dark. So it just shows the different eras we're living in now, with information on hand. Whenever we want information, we can just go on Twitter and type something in, and you get all the details. But it was just a different time then, and people just weren't aware of everything.
Yeah, true. Stu?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, a home World Cup or a home Olympic Games, you know, these are the things that, you know, are the ultimate sort of athlete's ambition. You know, it's the ultimate to take part in, isn't it? If you've got a home event, how do you, like you said, Gary, make a really good point. It's not going to end anything. It's not going to change anything. And so how do you go about making that decision? And you can't blame a professional athlete for not wanting to take part in what is essentially going to be the pinnacle of their career. And you're absolutely right as well, Dan. You know, who are we to judge 40 years down the line on decisions that were made in a continent that we didn't live in, under a regime that we've never experienced? It is incredibly difficult to, you know, to make those decisions about people. But you also, you know, talk about lack of information. And I would imagine, Dan, as well, and you'll know better than I will, I'm assuming it was obviously state-controlled media as well, which will also hamper the information that's coming out in the first place, you know, so let alone the lack of access to information, you've also got somebody controlling the information as well, which is going to make it even more difficult.
Yeah, no, completely. That's what it is. It's the time that we were living in, plus this, you know, state controlling the media. They only will release what they want you to hear. And just going back to when we talked about the war in 1982, a lot of, I hate to use the term winning because, you know, does anyone actually ever win in a war? But the Argentine players, before they arrived in Spain for the World Cup, they actually were under the impression that they were winning the war because that's what they'd seen on national television. So yeah, the military dictatorship will obviously only be releasing what they want you to hear.
Yeah. I hope the listeners will sort of forgive us for concentrating a lot on Argentina, but I guess alongside Brazil, Argentina are the sort of foremost country in South America with regards to football. Just want to touch on the sort of the perhaps domestic football scene in Argentina, obviously tapping into your knowledge of living there for 12 months and how the government influenced football there, and has the government used that sort of thing, or do political parties use football? Are certain politicians there wrapping themselves around the glory of particular clubs?
Well, the politics and football is indelibly linked, you know, but going back then and today as well. Back then, I'll touch on back then before we go into a bit more of a contemporary subject. But if you look at Maradona, for example, he was almost kept behind in his home country until the 1982 World Cup. And the agents who manufactured his deal to Barcelona talked of actually going to the ESMA, the naval school, the concentration camp, and directly negotiating with the high-ranking members of the military regime to release Maradona. So even back then they were, you know, controlling the domestic game behind the scenes, trying to make it as strong as possible. Going forward to today, there's a couple of different things you could talk about. It's a really, obviously a really deep subject, but the one of the things is the TV situation. So the TV, it used to be privatised, so all, like it is here with Sky, but in 2009, The government, it was a left-leaning government, they basically nationalised the football coverage. They took it off the private company and they put it on free-to-air TV. So that was great for me when I was there because you could just literally watch every single match. And it was up until about 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, you could watch every single match on YouTube as well. So regular Sunday night for me was just putting on YouTube, typing in the game, and it was just there, crystal clear. But obviously it was costing the government an absolute fortune, so, you know, a lot of people were against it, and, you know, they were for it because it was free football, but also Veron, Gary, you'll know well from his time at Chelsea, played for United as well, he said, he's obviously a key figure at the moment in Argentine football, but he said, you know, it's great that we've got this, great that we've got a national game free to air that everyone can watch, but, you know, I'm not happy if it's at the expense of schools and hospitals. So, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions were spent on this, and it's the classic opium of the masses, isn't it? You know, keep everyone happy. Let's do a bit of saber rattling about the Falklands, the Malvinas, and let's give everyone a free football, and then everyone will keep quiet about the economy. That's basically the government stance on it. Since it's been privatised again, so while that's probably not a bad thing for the clubs, they'll get a bit more money, but not good for people like me who want to watch it from over here.
Did the government that made it free to air, did they profit from it politically? Did they get, you know, win more elections because of it?
Basically it was the Cristina. She's quite a famous figure, polarising figure, known pretty much known by her first name, a bit like Madonna. She succeeded her husband, and they were in charge for about 10-15 years, as a sort of, you know, him first, and then when he passed away, she carried the torch. So they were quite popular for some time, and I was talking about waves, you know, the waves of politics before. They were sort of riding a leftist wave across Latin America that started just before the millennium, and obviously probably suffered in the fact that we've now got a wave going towards the right-hand side. But yeah, they like I said, saber-rattling about the Falklands and the Malvinas, often using football. She also tried to tie the football rights to the military regime, which is quite bizarre. She talked of the goals and the highlights being kidnapped and disappeared, you know, just like all the people were by the regime, which is a bit of a strange comment, really. And she, when she nationalised the football, she said, you know, no longer will our national game be kidnapped by these privateers. And quite a sort of not a very nice thing to compare to, really. Not very sensitive. Other things. I mean, you've got the economy as well. That's hugely affecting, and I guess you can say that economy and politics are hugely intertwined. And the economy is not in the best of shape, and that's also affecting the national game in terms of the weakening of the league. You know, young players coming over to Europe a lot earlier. I think one more key thing that I can probably touch on is the issue with the hooliganism in Argentina as well. Just like in England in the 70s and 80s, this kind of thing breeds when there's a lot of austerity. You've got a lot of, you know, people feeling disenfranchised, and that's the same over there. A lot of the hooligan groups over in Argentina sprung up back in the 90s when you had a lot of austerity and neoliberal policies, and they've sort of thrived. They thrived underneath the last government as well. You know, like I was talking about the TV rights being nationalised, loads of money was flooding in, and they just thrived. And unlike over in England now, they're a lot more organised than they ever were in England. It's basically organised crime with, you know, drugs, extortion. They control match day operations in terms of tickets and parking and stuff. And you can tie that really to politics and say that's breeded because of political decisions.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, Argentina, it's a fascinating country, isn't it? It's fascinating for its politics, it's fascinating for its football. There's so many questions that I could still ask you, Dan. I suppose, obviously, the politics with regards to Argentina is fascinating because it was so prevalent and on such a global scale in terms of the 78 World Cup. Do you think Argentina are in a position to host another World Cup? And I'm trying to get two questions in here. And if they do, do you think again it would be used as a political tool if they were awarded the World Cup again?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of talk about the 2030 World Cup. So they've not decided yet, have they? Who's going to host that? I think 2026 and 2030 are the next ones that are up in the air, aren't they, after Russia and Qatar. There's a lot of talk about Uruguay being involved because 2030 will be the 100th year anniversary of the first ever World Cup, which was held in Uruguay. But Uruguay, there's no way they can host a World Cup. They've basically got one city, so there's absolutely no way. But there's been talk of Argentina and maybe even Paraguay coming on board, so that's a possibility for 2030. Will it happen? I don't know, because I don't really think that they've got the means to do it at the moment. They've got you know, amazing stadia, but a lot of them need a lot of work. You've got the problem with the hooliganism problem. And the economy is in a terrible state at the moment. It's probably the worst for not far off 20 years. So I don't really think it's the right thing. Obviously, it would be great, and I'd love to get over there if it was the case. But obviously the politicians would use it to their own end. But I think we saw in Brazil as well that there was a lot of opposition to the World Cup. like I mentioned before, with Veron's quote about the, you know, expensive schools and hospitals, there are a lot more pressing issues in Argentina than hosting the World Cup.
The voice of reason, Dan. It's a shame because they bring so much vibrancy, don't they, Argentine supporters? Argentine football is so vibrant, and it would be great to have a World Cup there, but to be, I bow to your common sense, Dan.
I think,
well played, sir.
I think the issue with the World Cups now is that we're coming to the stage where only certain countries are going to be able to host it, which is a sad thing, but also inevitable, you know, that you're going to have these either joint World Cups or just the really powerful established economies that are able to host it. And I just don't think that Argentina are in that position.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there, Dan. Absolutely bang on there with that comment.
Yeah, it's a sad reflection, though, isn't it? I remember the Argentina World Cup and the sort of passion you have in there. And it almost wasn't the same in Brazil, but to the old days when they used to alternate between Europe and South America seemed so much more equitable, shall we say.
Yeah, and I think it
checks in the dollar, you know what I mean?
I think it would be nice if they could host it and then almost exercise the ghosts of 78, because, you know, that World Cup is just linked, you know, rightly or wrongly, and we've talked about before that we don't know, you know, there's a lot of grey areas, but, you know, rightly or wrongly, that World Cup is tied to the regime. You can't get away with it. So it would be nice maybe if they could host the World Cup at some point and then just, you know, almost banish those demons.
Yeah. Okay, as Stu mentioned, you know, we've probably got 17,000 questions each that we'd like to ask you, but time's a great enemy in the political football pods. We always like to close the same question, though, so I'm going to sort of put this one to you, Dan. And you can choose to answer this in relation to Chile or Argentina or both or wherever you want to. So the question of this is, can football exist in a political vacuum? In other words, is the political football inevitable?
I'd say yes and no. So no, you know, they will always coexist. I don't think you can get away from it. You know, you've got, I mean, you look at the World Cup, for example. Is that not a political event? You've got flags, you know, you could argue that flags and national anthems, probably going a bit too deep here, but, you know, flags and national anthems, are they not political symbols in themselves? So how can you ever get away from that? You know, you look in the crowd, Vladimir Putin at the last World Cup, Angela Merkel, Macron from France, they're all there in the crowd, and the cameras are panning to them. They're trying to get involved and trying to tie themselves to it to buy a bit of goodwill. You know, you've got, I remember at the World Cup just gone, you know, Boris Johnson trying to get himself involved as well, sort of trying to tie himself to it. I think as long as football is such a huge game across the world, and it's the world game, isn't it? You know, it's the most popular sport. It brings in millions and millions of pounds, and I think as long as it's so powerful, you know, you'll always draw in politicians, and in that way you can never separate it, really. On a positive note, though, I'll say, and probably just to touch on what Stephen mentioned when he talked about, you know, during the 90 minutes, you almost forget about politics. And I think he's right. You know, I was hugely sceptical about the most recent World Cup, and I'm hugely sceptical about Qatar and all the stuff that's going on around it. But I really enjoyed the World Cup, and, you know, I came home from work and it was a nice sunny night, you know, watched the game with the patio doors open and a beer, and I wasn't thinking about politics then. I was just enjoying the World Cup, and so I think in that sense it's a, you know, I think I'll sit on the fence and say yes and no.
It's a great positive note to end on, and you know, I think all football fans would agree with you that, you know, when the whistle blows, nobody cares about bloody politics. You want to watch the game and enjoy the game of football. But when it's full time, you know, I suppose you come back to reality and recognise the things that are going on that you don't necessarily like or approve of, but they're still there anyway.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Yeah. So just want to say thanks, Dan, for coming on and sharing your knowledge and enthusiasm about South American football. When we opened up the discussion, Stu and I were saying that we thought this was going to be a fascinating discussion, and you've knocked it out of the park, mate. Just absolutely smashed it. You've been fantastic, good guest. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it, and like you said, we could talk for hours, and you could probably even do about 5 podcasts just on this very subject. But I think, you know, we've covered it quite well within an hour. It's been enjoyable.
Great, fantastic. So thanks, Dan, for coming on there. And Stu, any final thoughts?
Well, to be fair, you've both summed it up. It's the good and the bad thing about this series is it's fascinating. There's so much information, but all it's really done is just given me thousands of questions that I now need to go away and either look up, think about, or message Dan, is what I'm going to be doing in about 10 minutes' time.
The political football, it causes more questions than it gives answers.
That might be the tagline.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing. So I would say thank you very much again to Dan, and thanks to Stu, my co-host, as always. Thanks to listeners for taking the time to listen to what we've got to say on the political football, and I hope you'll catch us next time. Thank you very much, and good night.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.